So there haven't been too many days of which it could truly be said, this is a momentous day. Viewed in relation to world history, this is a momentous day. There haven't been too many of those, but the day the people of Israel departed from Egypt, the day of the Exodus, as we call it, it's in that category. It's huge. It's unquantifiably huge. And our passage this morning then records its arrival. This is it, verse 4. Today, in the month of Abib, you are going out. Exodus 13 is transporting us to one of history's most epic moments. And what we find in the passage is that the Israelites then, they don't simply traipse out of Egypt and that's that. I mean, that would be anticlimactic, wouldn't it? An event of this magnitude cries out for a speech. And so we have a speech. The actual exit from Egypt is recorded from verse 17 in this chapter. The bit we're looking at this morning, verses 1 to 16, it's Moses addressing the Israelites, or most of it is anyway. Moses marking this massive occasion with a speech. And the way he begins it in verse 3 really sums up its whole message. Remember this day in which you came out from Egypt. Remember, remember, remembering is the theme of this passage. And in that connection then, there are three things worth highlighting. First of all, serious remembering. Serious remembering. Dan Walker is one of the regular hosts of BBC Breakfast, and he's also, as many of you will know, a Christian, but that's irrelevant to what I'm about to say now. As a host on a breakfast program, Dan Walker has, of course, to get up pretty early in the morning. And so apparently he has four alarms set. One to go off at 3:25, the next at 3:26, the next at 3:27, and then a final one at 3:29. He would be in very hot water indeed, of course, if he failed to show up on a live national broadcast. He cannot afford to sleep in, and so he's serious about the measures he employs for waking himself up. And likewise, the Israelites cannot afford to forget the Exodus. It's just an absolute no-no. It must not happen. And so God is serious about the measures he employs for jogging their memories. Moses' speech here really emphasizes that. So he talks about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That's one of God's key measures for jogging the Israelites' memories. Verses 6 and 7. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten for 7 days. No leavened bread shall be seen with you, and no leaven shall be seen with you in all your territory. And then verse 10. You shall therefore keep this statute at its appointed time from year to year. And we thought about this particular phenomenon when we were in chapter 12, so I won't comment again on it now. But here's the interesting thing that emerges in this morning's passage. It isn't enough. It isn't enough. A week-long annual commemoration isn't enough. In God's view, Israelite memories need more of a stimulus than that. And so, as well as the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Moses talks about the consecration of the firstborn. Like the Feast of Unleavened Bread, he has received this concept directly from God himself. We discover that in verses 1 and 2. The Lord said to Moses, "Consecrate to me all the firstborn." In Moses' speech itself, it becomes clear that this consecration of the firstborn is a nuanced thing. It applies differently in different situations. So when it's a firstborn animal belonging to a species that is clean, remember the Sinai law is soon going to be revealed, and in it the animals will be divided into clean animals and unclean animals. So when it's a firstborn animal belonging to a species that is clean, that means it's eligible to be offered as a sacrifice, and that's what should be done with it. A firstborn clean animal is consecrated to God by being offered as a sacrifice. Toward the end of verse 15 there, I sacrifice to the Lord all the males that first open the womb. When, however, it's a firstborn animal belonging to a species that's unclean, that means it's not eligible to be offered as a sacrifice. Moses here singles out a donkey as an example of this, probably because donkeys were commonly owned as work animals. Many people would have a donkey, and donkeys were unclean animals. And so sacrifice then, being in this case out of the question, a firstborn unclean animal is instead redeemed, verse 13. That is to say, it's kept by its owner, but only through a payment being made. That payment, that redemption, thus consecrates the firstborn animal to God. And redemption is likewise the means of consecration when it's a firstborn human. In this case, of course, sacrifice is even more out of the question. God abhors human sacrifice like he abhors pretty much nothing else. No, rather than being sacrificed, firstborn humans are to be redeemed, verse 13 and verse 15, and in that way consecrated to God. Now, let's think then about how the consecration of the firstborn would work on Israelite memories. Let's think chronologically. And many animals, of course, would be born in the springtime. Lots of firstborn animals would need to be consecrated then. And that would coincide with the Feast of Unleavened Bread, because it too was a springtime thing. But what about the consecration of firstborn humans? Would that be a solely springtime phenomenon? Well, of course not. Amongst a large population like the Israelites, there would be births taking place all year round, and thus consecrations taking place all year round. This particular appeal then to Israelite memories, it wasn't seasonal and contained, it was pervasive and incessant. And so you can perhaps see then the similarity to Dan Walker's alarms. He's not allowed to languish in sleep. Even if alarms 1 and 2 don't get him up and off to that BBC studio, alarms 3 and 4 will. And similarly, the Israelites aren't allowed to languish in forgetfulness. Even if the annual Feast of Unleavened Bread doesn't put them in a state of continual Exodus remembrance, the relentless consecration of firstborn will. Actually, notice that Moses himself has his own analogy for the kind of serious remembering that God is imposing on the Israelites. And it's not Dan Walker's alarms. Moses' analogy is the practice of doing something to your body to make you remember something. He talks about this in verse 9 and in verse 16. So you might focus on your hand and put some kind of mark on your hand to make you remember something. Or you might even, he says, attach something to your forehead that will kind of hang down in front of your eyes, and that will keep reminding you of something. Moses is saying that God's Feast of Unleavened Bread and consecration of firstborn, they are comparable to those literally in your face memory jogging devices that we might use from time to time. So God clearly isn't content with the occasional, superficial recollection of the Exodus by his people. He wants serious remembering to be going on. And I'm sure you know what I'm going to say next and how I'm going to apply this. I said that the Exodus is a momentous event in the history of this world, and indeed it is, but there's a more momentous event than that. The death and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. As Christians, we owe absolutely everything this morning to that, don't we? We owe everything to the death and resurrection of Jesus. It's not one factor. It's not one ingredient. in our blessed and privileged status this morning. We owe everything to it. Everything to the death and resurrection of Jesus. What serious remembering that warrants then. And so I ask the question, are you and I powerfully, keenly, vividly aware in our daily lives that the Son of God once died and rose for us? I've never been one myself for writing reminders to myself on my hand. Some of you may do that, and I should imagine that it's pretty effective. It's not without reason, is it, that we use expressions like, I know that place, like the back of my hand. I mean, we're always seeing our hands. We know every vein, every wrinkle, every scar on our hands. The Israelites then were to look at the Exodus as often as they looked at their hands. That's the force of verse 9 and verse 16. They were to look at the Exodus as the years went by following it, and the centuries went by. They were still to look back at the Exodus as often as they looked at their hands. Do we have anything like that kind of intense, vital relationship with the death and resurrection of Jesus? Or is it just in the distant background of our consciousness? Like the cricket is for me. I turn on the radio at the minute and, oh yes, England are playing some cricket match, aren't they? I'm a strange sort of Yorkshireman, I know. But I have only a very peripheral kind of half awareness that some test match or other is going on. But oh, to live in a state of soul-gripping awareness of Jesus' saving work. To live in a state of soul-gripping awareness of Jesus' saving work. To be thinking of it continually, repeatedly, inveterately. To be constantly going back to it in our minds. Wow, the Son of God loved me, died for me, and rose again from the dead. Serious remembering. Secondly this morning, strategic remembering. Strategic remembering. So I used the language earlier that the Israelites cannot afford to forget the Exodus. Well, why can't they? Why is it so important to remember? Is it just that God is big on nostalgia? And that's why he sets up all these different devices, the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the consecration of the firstborn, for jogging the Israelites' memories. Is he just a nostalgic deity? Well, no, that's not the reason. Rather, their serious remembering of the Exodus is beneficial and productive. That's what I mean by this second heading, strategic remembering. Their remembering is strategic, in fact, in two ways. First of all, in relation to the land. In relation to the land, the Israelites have been promised a land. The land is mentioned twice in our passage, in verse 5 and in verse 11. And in both cases, two emphases come across. Number one, a sense of certainty. John L. Mackay, in his commentary, highlights that it's when, not if. When the Lord brings you into the land, verse 5. Again, when the Lord brings you into the land, verse 11. There's no hint of a doubt here. It's going to happen. The Israelites are getting a land. But then emphasis number two, the fact that the land presently belongs to others. That's particularly prominent in verse 5, the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, but it's clear in verse 11 as well, the land of the Canaanites. So this is not an empty land just waiting for a new owner. It has inhabitants, numerous, well-established, deeply rooted inhabitants. So those are the two emphases that come across when the land is mentioned in this passage, and they don't seem all that compatible, do they? These two emphases. Surely emphasis number two seriously undermines emphasis number one. Surely if the land presently belongs to others, there can be no sense of certainty about Israel taking possession of it. Surely that intimidating list of people groups, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, surely it renders Israel's inheritance of the land more of an if than a when, and a pretty remote, dubious if at that. Well, this is one reason then why it's so important the Israelites remember the Exodus. Now, there are lots of repeated phrases in our passage. Perhaps the most notable is the repeated phrase, strong hand. Verse 3, by a strong hand the Lord brought you out from this place. Verse 9, with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. Verse 14, by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. Verse 16, by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. The Exodus was a display of God's irresistible might. We've seen, haven't we, over recent weeks, how fiercely opposed to it was the most powerful human emperor on the planet. In political terms and in military terms, the Exodus was inconceivable. An absurd impossibility. There was no way this bunch of slaves could defy Pharaoh and just up and leave. It couldn't happen. And yet it did happen. God reached out his strong hand. God exerted his awesome power. And political and military factors became inconsequential. Pharaoh's opposition became a complete irrelevance. The Exodus, I'm saying, was a display of God's irresistible might. And if then the Israelites proceeded towards the promised land, remembering the Exodus, then they wouldn't be fazed by the land's apparent unavailability. So what if it's presently owned by others, they would say. So what if the odds seem to be stacked against us taking possession of it? We've been here before. Going into Canaan is no less feasible than going out of Egypt was. These are just the kind of situations in which our God loves to display his irresistible might. The same strong hand that got the job done then in Egypt will get this new job done now in Canaan. I'm saying remembering the Exodus would furnish Israel with confidence and assurance regarding their dubious looking future. And as Christians, we also have a future promised to us, which at times, if we're honest, can look pretty dubious, can't it? It can look dubious because we reason, there's no way God can really love me that much, that he's going to bestow on me this lavish inheritance that he talks about in his word. Then again, it can look dubious because we reason, even God can't really be powerful enough to bring it about. Even for him, this is just too big an ask. What's the antidote to these kinds of misgivings that you and I sometimes entertain? Well, for us, like for the Israelites, it's remembering. Remembering. Remembering, in our case, Jesus' death and resurrection. Remembering Jesus' death, we then say with Paul, he who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not graciously along with him give us all things? Romans 8:32. God at Calvary gave me the hardest thing possible to give. His own son. He loves me that much. He will certainly give me the rest. The eternal inheritance he has promised. And then remembering Jesus' resurrection, we say with Paul, by his power God raised the Lord from the dead and he will raise us also. 1 Corinthians 6:14. God on Easter Sunday morning proved decisively that he's powerful enough to do the things he has promised to one day do for me. powerful enough to open my tomb and pour into my dead body resurrection life. I'm saying for us, just as much as for the Israelites, our confidence and assurance regarding what God is going to do in the future depend in no small part on us remembering what God has done in the past. It's as we remember the death and resurrection of Jesus that we confidently anticipate the eternal inheritance that's to come. So the Israelites remembering is strategic in relation to the land, but then secondly, it's strategic in relation to the law. In relation to the law, soon the law is going to be given to the Israelites on Mount Sinai. And it's an exacting law. It's a big law. It's a strenuous law. A law that will require strenuous effort, that is, to keep, to obey. And it's always going to be tempting then for the Israelites not to do so, to disregard this law that is so demanding and so exacting. It's not going to be plain sailing by any means to keep this law that they're going to be given at Sinai. There's always going to be the temptation to abandon it and disregard it. And this is another reason why it's so important then that they remember the Exodus. Verse 9. Look at verse 9. It shall be to you as a sign on your hand. This is the Feast of Unleavened Bread that Moses is talking about at this particular point. It shall be to you as a sign on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes. We've talked about that. Why? That the law of the Lord may be in your mouth. That the law of the Lord may be in your mouth. The point is then that remembering what God had done for them in the Exodus, they will then want to obey this law. It will be on their lips. It will be in their mouth. They'll be reciting it and rehearsing it often. They will love it. They will want to do anything they can to express their gratitude and devotion to this God who had redeemed them so spectacularly and so wonderfully. And it's the same for us. Sometimes when you and I are failing in some area of God's law, we perhaps tend to address that in this way. We start to beat ourselves over the head with that particular area of God's law, that particular command that we're struggling with, and we kind of try and ram it down our throats and beat ourselves with it. I must keep this command. I must do better with it. And that's the approach we take. You know, there's a better approach than that, which is to preach the gospel to ourselves and you and remind ourselves of what Jesus did for us in his death and resurrection. Because that will win our hearts afresh to God's law. That will make us want to obey God's commands. Then it won't be this duty that we're ramming down our throats. It will then be this desirable thing, because we're so thankful to the God who has done so much for us. And so, if you're struggling this morning in some area of the Christian life, some area of obedience to God, perhaps it's to the gospel you need to return. Perhaps you need to remind yourself of what Jesus did for you 2,000 years ago. Perhaps you need to go back to the cross and to the empty tomb. So this remembering then, it's serious remembering, it's strategic remembering. But then thirdly and finally, sophisticated remembering. Sophisticated remembering. So occasionally our dishwasher is full and ready to go on, but I'm about to leave the house, and they always tell you, don't they, that you're not supposed to put the dishwasher on when you're going out of the house in case it causes a fire when you're out. And so to remind myself to put the dishwasher on when I come back, I put the kettle on the floor near the dishwasher. And it's a fairly crude way of doing it, but it works because I know I'll be having a coffee when I come back in, and so that will remind me. But as I say, it's a rather primitive aid memoir, this one, isn't it? Because there's no intrinsic connection then between the dishwasher and the kettle. These aid memoirs that we have here in Exodus 13, they're less crude, aren't they? They're less primitive than that because there is a clear connection between unleavened bread and the Exodus, because on the night of the Exodus, they ate unleavened bread. And there is a clear connection between firstborn and the Exodus, because, of course, the Egyptians' firstborn were killed on that night. So there are these connections, but still, I suppose, we could think, well, it's still a little bit primitive. These aid memoirs, they're a bit crude. It's almost as though, kind of, God has just gone for some random objects associated with the story. And, oh yeah, unleavened bread, that was part of it, so that can serve as an aid memoir. Oh yes, firstborn, they can too. But that's not the case here. And of course, we've already seen this, haven't we, when it comes to unleavened bread. Remember, we talked about this a few weeks ago. We said that actually, yes, the unleavened bread was simply a powerful reminder, jogging their memories of what had happened the night of the Exodus, but it was also establishing a theological principle. Namely, the principle of discontinuity, of separation. Remember we said the thing about leaven was that you were using some of the last batch of dough. The thing about unleavened bread was that you were using nothing from the past. It expressed discontinuity, separation, a clean break with the past. And that was an important theological principle then, that the Israelites weren't to live any longer as they had lived in the past. They weren't to pursue idols any longer as they had pursued idols in the past. So the unleavened bread wasn't just jogging their memories, it was expressing a theological principle, that of separation from sinful pasts. Now, what about the consecration of the firstborn? Well, I will put it to you that this too isn't just about jogging memories, although it does achieve that. Here too, we have a theological principle being established. What's the principle? Well, it's this. That which God saves, he also possesses. That's the simple principle being expressed in the consecration of the firstborn. That which God saves, he also possesses. You see, the night that the Lord passed through Egypt, it was specifically Israel's firstborn that were saved through the blood of the Lamb, wasn't it? It was those firstborn that would otherwise have been killed. It was Israel's firstborn that were saved through the blood of the lambs. And so, God says in verse 2 of our passage that the firstborn are mine. Those I saved, I now possess. The firstborn, he says, are mine. And yes, as I explained earlier, in certain cases, firstborn offspring of both animals and certainly of humans could be kept. But even then, a price had to be paid, and so you were made keenly aware that really these firstborn belong to God. What God had saved on the night of the Exodus, he claims as his own. And verse 15 brings this across strikingly, doesn't it? When Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of animals. So he killed the Egyptians' firstborn. Therefore, our firstborn are all completely free for us to do with them what we like. That's what you'd expect. That's the logical consequence, isn't it? The Egyptians' firstborn were killed, ours were spared, therefore we can do what we like with ours because we've held on to them. No. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all the males that first opened the womb, and all the firstborn sons I redeem. This is the logic of this passage and the Exodus, but this is the logic of the whole Bible as well then. That what God saves, he also possesses. And of course, we then are those who have been saved through the blood of the Lamb. And the same applies to us then. Being saved by the blood of the Lamb doesn't mean that now we are free to live for ourselves and live as we would want to do, which actually, of course, is no freedom at all. But it means that we are possessed by the one who has saved us. It's what Paul talks about, isn't it? In 1 Corinthians 6, you are not your own. You have been bought with a price. You are not your own. Those God saves, he also possesses. And so I just want to ask you this morning, do you understand that this is what it means to be a Christian? To be a Christian means to be saved, wonderfully saved from the wrath of God, saved from hell, saved from the judgment and damnation that we deserve. But it means being saved to be henceforth possessed, owned by God. He says, mine, of each person who is saved through the blood of Jesus Christ. That's what it means to be a Christian. To be not our own, but to belong, soul and body, to the one who has saved us. And if you are a Christian then, are you living like that? Every morning, reminding yourself as you get up, I'm not my own. This day is not my own. It's God's. I'm God's. My life, my all, is for him. May God help us to think like that. Amen. Let's close singing.